Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome back to Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey. Each episode, I'm talking to performers from film, television, and theatre about one significant role in their career. It might not always be the role they're most famous for, but in each one, I'll be trying to find out about the preparation, the excitement, and the sense of nostalgia that goes with any key role in an actor's lifetime. Adjua Ando is a British film, television, theatre, and radio actress. As well as playing lead roles at the National Theatre, the RSC, and the Royal Court, she's appeared in long-running roles in Doctor Who, Casualty and EastEnders, as well as being a member of the BBC Radio Drama Company. But in 2020, Adjua appeared as Lady Danbury in the groundbreaking Netflix Regency drama Bridgerton, a series with a record-breaking 82 million views. Earlier this year, I caught up with her to talk about that unique experience. Hey, my guest today is Adjua Ando, and we're talking about Lady Danbury in Bridgerton, set in the 19th century. This looked like great fun to do, was it?
Well, you know, when you put your corset on at 5 a.m., David, right, and then you put your comedy wig on, and then you take it off at about 8 p.m., by the end of the... You know.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I don't know if you know about corsets.
I've not been in a corset much, but I know what it's like.
Okay, yeah. So that, yeah. But, no, it was... It is great fun. I mean, the scripts have got a real swing and swagger to them. Mm-hmm. You know, every time a Regency drama is announced or a historical costume drama, my heart sinks slightly. I think, oh, that'd be another one we'll pass up. Yeah. So for me, as a black actor, it's great to go, and hello, here we are.
When you got the call from your agent, what was the brief straight off?
I guess it was Shonda Rhimes, who, you know, me and my kids grew up watching Grey's Anatomy. It was the law for several years. So Shonda Rhimes, amazing producer of content, black woman, done it on her own terms, great narrative drive person, had taken these books, these romantic historical fictions by a writer called Julia Quinn, which are hugely popular in their own right, and she was giving them the Shonda schwang, and it was going to be her first offering for Netflix. Right. So that combination is immediately interesting to me. My mother was a history teacher, so I grew up reading Jean Plaidy and Georgette Heyer, you know, so I could get my own adult ticket from the library so I could go and get my own. Because I love these books because you learn about history while being involved in Will They, Won't They.
But so, did you know Julia's books? Did you know?
No, because she's just not my era. You know, I'd stop sort of reading that sort of book because of time constraints and all sorts of things. Anyway, so that combination of Netflix, historical romance, Shonda Rhimes, and then the character of Lady Danbury, who's got such, you know, she's got gusto and verve and all those things that are really great fun to play. And I thought I can do something with her.
Did you know about her going in? Did you have an interview with Shona?
I had the sides and I met the casting director in Shoreditch one Friday afternoon when she had a train to catch and I would come from another job. So we just banged out and then off I went and she went and that was it. And I just thought, I'll just do my turn. You can have my turn and then I'll go away. And if they like it, they do. And if they don't, they don't. Right. But I sort of recognise women like her. They're sort of, they're the women that they're on both sides of my family. They're my sort of, they're my English grandmother's hearty women who ride bicycles and teach children and play tennis into their 60s and are in the WI and, you know, maybe carrying a broken heart somewhere along the line and all of that. You know, they're the sort of drivers of the nation in a way. And I recognize them on my Ghanaian side. They're my auntie in the 60s leaving Ghana because she wanted to do fashion and traveling to Milan and New York and Paris and London and buying clothes. And she was telling me stories last year of the lift was broken in this apartment she had in New York and carrying all these clothes she bought on her head up 16 flights of stairs. She said, "I think it broke my back." You know, and opening a and then opening a shop in Accra to sell international fashion. So they're these dynamic women who just kind of get on with it.
And she's right at the heart of the story, isn't she? I mean, because there's a lot of secrecy around these shows. Did it come to you in drip feed? Did it sort of, you had the pages and then did it go to a second stage or did they then send you the first script? Or how did the script and the story arrive to you?
I got sides for what was going to be her first appearance, you know, talking on screen as opposed to little montagey things they do. And she sort of leapt off the page there. You kind of knew everything you needed to know about her. Actually, some of that, the stuff that I got sent, didn't make it to the final edit. But when I read it, I had a clear sense of who I thought she was. I kind of almost knew sort of what she'd look like or how I wanted her to look. Because it was the first series, so the second series is different because it was the first series, though you sort of had an arc came pretty quickly of the eight episodes and the sort of direction they were going in. And obviously, you know, things go to a pink page and a blue page and the orange page and how many more colours of the rainbow do we have? But the basic shape was there pretty early on.
But it has a very distinct tone about it. What's wonderful about it is it's very secure in its tone.
Yeah, well, that's Chris Van Dusen. That's
and
the showrunner.
Would he sit down with you, Chris, and would he sit down with you as a cast, or would that guide of tone be on a daily scene-by-scene basis, or was there a discussion beforehand about this is the show we're making?
Well, so when we all sat down to the read through, it's very, you get the tone really clearly from Chris in the stage directions. So the stuff that the audience never sees, his stage directions they're like their own show. They're fabulous. They're anarchic. They're larky. They can be a bit sweary and quite funny. They're very funny. And then one of their senior producers would read the stage directions during the read through. Boy, she reads at a lick. She's like, and bang, and we're into season two. Well, not season two, we haven't done season two yet, but you know, and that's a cut to, and then we're on to the next thing. And it's like, bam, 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 bam. And so you know, if you weren't sure before, this is the frame of this Regency will they, won't they narrative. Mm-hmm. So it's immediately not like anything you've done before because it's got that American, you know, driving thrust to it. Everything drives. So pace is a real watchword on set. Mm-hmm. And then of course, Chris is an amazing showrunner because he's there every day. So I don't know how he does it. You know, he's got young family. I don't know how he does it.
So when you've got a showrunner and a director on set, is it a discussion between you all, or how does that dynamic work?
Yeah, I think there has to be, because the showrunner has to keep the overall tone of the series. Because I think there's nothing more distracting when the tone starts to wobble in a show. It's like, and it's something that directors have to buy into. I think it's not a Terrence Malick one-off extraordinary. We're just going to shoot at dusk and twilight, you know, dawn and twilight. So that's the buy-in. But then, of course, each director has their own slight taste, and of course, creative is going to be space for that. But you know, I did Casualty for 3 years, and I'm not comparing the two in many ways, but in some ways I am, in that you have a cast that knows who their character is. Mm-hmm. And you have exec producers who know what they want the tone of the world to be. And then you have directors who come in and bring that. So it's a constant process of negotiation. And then Chris is also head writer, but he has other writers coming in. So everybody's incrementally shifting all the time. Mm-hmm. And you're
constant in it, aren't you? You're the constant, yeah. Because it's your character. And
yeah. So, you know, the classic, like, my character would never do that, you know. You can only use that so far. Sure. So it's a contract that we all have to buy into.
But how did she emerge for you? So, you know, you've got the pages and then scripts are coming and stuff like that. You're talking about the influences of the women you know. Mm. When you're playing with that, when you're putting all those elements together of what you're feeling, is that just simply you and yourself and the mirror and of the voice and stuff like that? And then you might do it the read-through, or you might do it at a rehearsal. How do you create this stuff on your own before you release it, you know, show it to other people?
Yeah. I think it goes in stages. I spend a lot of time with the music of the lines and find out what's the music of this character. And that music takes me into, well, who's the person that would create that particular music? Why does it sound like this and not like, you know? So then I have to think about, who is she? Where's she from? What she lived through? How did she get into this position? Mm-hmm. You know, what are the, I suppose it's a bit, what are the compressions? A bit like, you know, how does a mineral become a diamond? Yeah. Or, you know, how do we get to coal? What are mm-hmm. the compressions that have made her the mm-hmm. object that we find at this point in her life? And I'm always really interested in that. So I think about the period. Mm-hmm. I think about her gender. I think about, in this case, I think about her race, because I'm playing the colour you see. It's not pretendy white lady. I think about class. I think about gender. I think about race. I think about the period. And then I think about, and then how does this unique personality push against all those things?
And is that she's part of the process you enjoy? Do you enjoy that?
I love
bit?
It. Yeah, I love it. That's why we do it, isn't it?
Yeah, I love that too.
That's I love that. And then having got all that on board, how do you make those words be honest to what you've discovered about that person?
And did you have those great, you know, there's a great flashback scene with, you know, the old Duke, and then there's a great speech you have with the present Duke. I mean, did you have that at your disposal when you were doing this work, or did they come later?
I didn't have that at my disposal when I started with the work. So when I got those scenes, they were a great encouragement, because I was like, okay, we're on the same page.
Right.
Yeah, and for me, you know, I don't know, you know, where this came from for Chris, but for me, the stuff about going, you know, the shouty person in the room is usually the one that's going, oh, fuck, oh, fuck, oh, fuck, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
And is the scared person who's like pushing it out by going, you know, look at the shouting, don't look at me, look at their light, look at my hands, look at blah, 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 blah. So, you know, and I really love that, because I think loads of people resonate with that, and that has nothing to do with your era, your gender, your race, your class, anything. That's a human thing that we all
that
feel.
That sort of never goes away, does it?
It never goes away. I resonate with it. And I listen to myself, you know, I'm listening to myself talking to you now, and I'm thinking about, you know, the days when I would be getting ready for school, and I'd be like, okay, when I go into school today, I'm going to be really quiet and mysterious. I'm going to be really thoughtful, and people are going to think, oh, she's so interesting. And then I'd get in and I'd be like, you know, and I'd be like, oh, I did it again.
What happened to my aloofness?
I know. Why can't I be sophisticated? I want to be sophisticated. but I do know that there was a certain point, quite little, at primary school. Prior to primary school, where I understood that my nana came round with her friend Daphne. And I remember Daphne was in a lemon twin set, and she had snowy white hair, and it was very permed and very nice. And Nana was quite proper. She would talk about licorice and staying in an hotel, things like that. She was also, you know, she could dig up the street if she needed her to. She came with Auntie Daffy, and I remember eyeing this woman up and thinking, I'm going to have to make her like me. She's not going to like me. So I remember going, thinking, okay, what am I going to do? So I went upstairs and I got my copy of Mrs. Tiggy Winkle, Beatrix Potter, and I took it downstairs and I just plonked myself on this woman's lap who didn't know me from a hole in the ground. I went, I'm going to read to you. And then, you know, and I read a Mrs. Tiggy Winkle. So at the end, she would think I was charming and lovely.
Right.
And I kind of understood that there's an element of performative stuff mm-hmm. that if you're scared and you think you're going to be not liked by Auntie mm-hmm. Daphne, do that, like head it off at the pass, just get
and,
in there
and
first.
Sort of create a character, isn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, I reflect on that now and I go, why does a 3-year-old girl already know that? Mm. What's that about? But I know that's still the case. Mm-hmm. And actually, one of the things that I've loved about Lady Danbury is just that thing of going at a certain point, do you know what? Drop the shit. Mm-hmm. Don't matter if she don't like you. Just live your life.
What I love about her is there's a very public part of her and there's a very private part of her.
Yeah.
And we see both of them, and that's what's really wonderful. So when you're working on your, say, you know, you're working on your own, you're looking at the character, you're finding the voice, the war, all those things. And then maybe the next people you meet in the process are hair and makeup and costume. How much say do you have in the look of her?
I have quite a lot of say, because I'm just at a stage now where, I have to have my say.
You're right.
But again, it's always it's a trade off, isn't it? It's like I'll do it for you for £10.50. Can you do £8? All right. Or what about £8? Seven, you know, it's exactly the same. It's you're always bartering, because obviously hair and makeup, they're super creative people as well, and they will have their own vision, and Chris is putting this jigsaw puzzle together. So he'll have his own vision of how he's been running the writer's room and how he's laying this thing out, where he knows he wants a character to develop. So he'll have a sense of what he wants as well. So there's always the negotiation. So, but at the same time, hair and makeup want you to be happy, because you're going to be sitting in that chair at 4:30 in the morning for 9 months, and they don't want you to be sitting there glaring at them for 9 months. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes a collaboration. So, you know, you negotiate what shade of, that lipstick? Mm-hmm. Nah, not feeling that. Yes, but for the period. Okay. Well, how about if we, so there's all the trade-offs and,
But like with costume, did they have like a colour palette for you? You know, because obviously they're looking at the whole thing. Did they? Is there a Danbury sort of colour palette?
Yes. So it's been predominantly sort of different shades of purple, deep purples and reds and blues. So it hasn't been greens and oranges, and yet, which is completely Featherington, and it hasn't been the pale lilac-y colours. That's complete. Not that I would want that. She's stronger meat than that.
Yeah.
That's been negotiation. One thing I was, so Lady Danbury has a cane. That's in the books, and I know that part of that is about she's an older woman, so she's got a cane. But for me, I'm not playing old lady. It's just not interesting. It's not interesting to me. And let's have the cane be more interesting than that. So there's something about using it as a piece of dynamism as well. So the top of the cane, I said, nobody's going to see it but me. And this is where you go, are you just disappearing up your own fundament, Ando? Get a grip. But the top of the cane has an elephant under a palanquin. Mm-hmm. You know, which is the sort of, I can't think what the word is, David.
It's like a canopy,
an awning.
Isn't it?
Yeah, that's a canopy. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. That comes from a colonial officer in the Gold Coast had that insignia made. So I wanted to have some connection with Africa, mm-hmm. and the Gold Coast formerly is now Ghana, which is where my dad's from. So I wanted to have that. in the palm of my hand. When she walks, she's got that rubbing on her hand. And it talks about Africa. It talks about colonization and power. So I just wanted that little knob on the top of the cane. So there's the cane. And then I wanted her to have hats because she's a widow. And I wanted her to embody the masculine and the feminine. And at that period, you know, men, it was a hat and cane and a watch chain. That's like de rigueur for that period. So I wanted her to have those elements as well. And then she has a big chunky ring, and I wanted that. That's her dead husband. So she carries her, so she's got love and geography and status embedded into her.
What
style.
I love about that is there, like you said before, you know, nobody's going to see this, but what happens to you as the actor is they sort of seep into your character. They become your character.
Yeah.
And sometimes, and I want to ask you about this as well. Sometimes in jobs, there's so much going on. And quite rightly, you know, there's hundreds of extras on this job. There's horses, there's lights, there's all the stuff behind the camera as well, that you need to have something that just focuses you into your character in a very immediate way. And if it's the cane, sometimes I have things like, I have a story around my shoes or something on my costume or something
exactly.
else. Sometimes I carry photographs with me, which I can just look at. They get you there. They're shorthand to get you, to remind you why you're there, who you are. Because some of those days they looked like, you know, you will have a big speech in the middle of a lot of chaos going on, won't you? So you have to look after yourself in those big scenes, don't you?
Yes, it's absolutely right, David. It's a grounding. You need anchoring. It's like a scaffold that you carry around with you that you can just pour yourself into when there's a lot of stuff that's not about your character whizzing around, and it just takes you back. It takes you back into the moment because that's the thing. It sounds really pontificity, but you'll know what I mean. It's about honouring. The person you've created is now a person, and you have to honour them in your representation of them. And it's about honouring that character, but it's also honouring the investment that the audience is making in that character. Yeah. It's like it's respecting the time they're giving you and the bit of their heart that they will be pouring into, whether they love you or hate you or whatever. But we pour a bit of ourselves into those characters when we're watching those narratives. So for me, it's about honouring the character and honouring the viewer and all the people that have worked to make that person go.
And, you know, tonally about the show is there's a lot of, like, froth around it. There's a lot of sort of, you know, it's a fun ride. But every now and again, as the viewer, there's a real seriousness underlining it about status, class, all these things, about who you are, about love, about betrayal, and men and women and all those things. And they really, as a piece, it really does play with those two things. And that's what I mean about the tone. And I guess this sometimes you can, that's what's nice to have Chris around, I think, is the fact that there's an outside eye saying, push that a bit more or bring that back a bit more.
Exactly. What I think so smart about it is it's like undercover, you know. But what it says is, you know, you bring yourself to the piece and there will be something, you know, you will spot something that somebody else won't spot. You know, and if you just want to come and watch a frothy romp and go, oh, look at that frock. That's a nice house. I don't know. Do you think they will? Or I think I'll put the kettle on now because that's a bit too much sex for me. You know, all of that. It's all
the kettle
all
is
there.
Going on a lot in my house.
It's, me too. I'm like, I just have I turned into my dad? Yes, I have. You know, turn the paper here. Where's wrong? You know, all of that. So, oh, I think the dog needs a walk or whatever it is. But, so all that's going on and I love the fact that you can get it at whatever level you know there's stuff about grief, there's stuff about gay relationships, women wanting more from their lives than being chattels, having agency, there's even a little bit about race in there, but you know, you catch it if you catch it and
but
you
also,
don't catch
that,
it
that bit is, you know, there's a lot of historical inaccuracies in this show. But the Queen is a real, you know, that's an amazing piece of history, isn't it? That we don't know. Not that we don't know, but we're not told.
Absolutely. So I suppose I would say the show is probably more historically accurate than any other Regency drama you will have seen. Mm-hmm. There were 20,000 free black people in London in this period. A fifth of the British Navy was of African heritage. If you go to the bottom of Nelson's column, the dying Nelson is in the arms of a black sailor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like, and there were people from Asia, from Africa, anywhere that was being colonized, they were in London in this period because, you know, slavery, colonization were the great fuelers. We were just really getting into our pomp in this bit of the Hanoverian period. The Wars of the Americas, all of that. So there were a lot of free black Americans in London who had fought with the British in America and had been rewarded by being allowed to come over here. So you're like, this, like, it's mad. You got China's coming up at this. So, yeah. So our show is saying it's not a documentary. We're doing this on steroids. So you will see more of everything. Mm-hmm. The Featheringtons will be in psychedelic green. No, it's not, period. The cut is, though. So, yeah. You know, there's all that going on as well. Yeah.
And Queen Charlotte.
And Queen Charlotte, thank you. Queen Charlotte is descended from Alfonso III of Portugal and his African mistress, whatever she was. There was a lot of trade going on with the royal kingdoms of Africa between the Portuguese and those kingdoms from the 14th century. So, I mean, Portugal were the first great slavers, and then we came in second. There in the Iberian royal families of Portugal and Spain, there was a lot of a much more interracial mixing than you would be allowed to have seen or learned about in history or any of that stuff. And Charlotte is part of that. The Hanoverians, they like to marry their own. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't marry an English person. They would go to Germany, Saxony, all around that area and marry someone from there. And Charlotte that's how she comes over. And she's the one that brings the Christmas tree. We have Charlotte to thank for the Christmas tree, not Albert. Once you know that she's mixed race and you see paintings of her, you go, oh yeah, I see it. When she was born, there were complaints about her mulatto appearance. When she came over to England, people complained about her ugly, thick lips and her wide nose. Mm-hmm. They knew what that meant. The dog whistle was up. Mm-hmm. Where I grew up, we filmed at a place called Badminton House, which is about 5 miles from where I grew up in the Cotswolds. There is this, it's where they did when Danbury has her ladies' soiree,
yeah,
the gambling and the drinking and the carrying on scene. Sure. And that was filmed there. And so... there's a huge picture of Queen Charlotte there. I took a photograph of me with Ulrich Riley, who was the director of those episodes. I would have loved, as a little black kid growing up in the Cotswold in the 60s, mm-hmm. to have known that 5 miles up the road, there's a queen, mm-hmm. and she looks a bit like me. Yeah. And it's okay. We've been here for a long time.
I think that's the one of the things in the show that, you know, is just so wonderful to sort of... And the world that she could reimagine, you know, that's what I loved about it. And I think that's what Chris has brought to the show. And do you think, I mean, it feels like a bit of a game changer to me as a show. Does that feel right to you?
Yeah, it does. Absolutely. Because and I know it is, because I know there are loads of dramas coming down the pipeline from all different platforms now that will never go back to doing all white costume dramas again. That it's just like, it's too old fashioned now. And because the show is the biggest Netflix show, it's had the biggest viewership of any Netflix show ever. People don't need to be doing it for right on reasons. They just need to go, the appetite in the market is there.
Yeah. And people, so, you know, if you build it, people will come. I mean, they are, you know, it is such a huge success. You mentioned that party in your house.
Yes.
Can you just talk me those days? There's a lot of them. Those big days. I mean, just talk me through a day like that, particularly in a costume like you're wearing. You alluded to it before about when your day starts and ends. But what are they like?
Long. They're long. So my wigs probably, you know, look, I'm not doing them any favours. Sorry, this is audio, but as you can see, David, my hair's quite long for me at the moment, so it's about half an inch. and so Dad is not the hair department's friend. They kind of looked at me with horror because that wig is those wig makers are astonishing, because it's a mission to make me look like I've got a head of hair. And that mission takes a lot of time to create. So I'm in makeup. I'm quite often in makeup as they're setting up. And on those big ball days, big party days, there's 70 bajillion people to get in. So there's a cast of supporting artists that is enormous, plus the dancers. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of regulars, because those scenes are usually where everybody comes to the ball. So there's loads of regulars to get in. So makeup, they've got steam coming out of their ears by about 8:30 in the morning. So those days, they're super long days. They're really long days. And it's like, this is the day to have your boiled egg, love, and have your slow release porridge, because
you're not going to have lunch.
Yeah. And don't eat too much starch, because after lunch you're going to keel over.
And do you have rehearsal? Are you able to? I presume the dancers would have had rehearsal before you even got there. But are you able to rehearse on the day, or did you have any rehearsal before you start?
You may have a rehearsal morning for stuff that's coming up. In a way, you get your lip in after a while. You sort of know what's coming and how you need to approach it. So it's all very much, you know, really focused and by the numbers. So we're going to go from here, and then we're going to pan over to there, and then it's going to come through here, and then you'll rehearse that little section. You'll rehearse that little section, and obviously those big days, you will break down a scene. So a ballroom scene will be five scenes. So the geography has to be completely on point, so it all glues together properly. So you can be shooting a scene for, you know, a week, and it may look fabulous and frothy and fun, but that's the skill of everybody.
Definitely.
I know you
were joking about your slow release porridge and stuff like that, but there's a seriousness about how one looks after oneself over a long period. I mean, you said 9 months before.
Yeah.
I mean, your energy is a real important thing, and only you know what your energy is like and what you need. I mean, you've got to really treat yourself in a different way for those long shoots and those long days, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, I know I need to know, when are my heavy days? When are my emotionally very particular days? So, you know, some days... on set between scenes, you'll be chatting and gassing and just having a lovely time. And other days you're like, all right, you can all bugger off now, because I just got to focus on this. Yeah. I don't know if this has got harder as I've got older, but I really like to have the words in my mouth before a big thing. And I don't want to have other people's stuff in my head, so I will go away and just burble in a corner like the madwoman, and I find that comforting.
Would you ever grab another actor for that, or would you do it on your own? Would you ever say to someone,
I have no pride in going to someone and going, can we just run this?
Great.
Can we run it again? But if they say I don't want to, I'd rather just, then that's cool as well, and I'll just go and do it on my own.
I think that's because, you know, we all make great friends on these jobs because they are so intense, and they sort of, you know, that ensemble nature. But I think it's always good to talk about the fact that it's fine every now and again to say, look, I need a different head on today. I need to, you know, and I think your actors, your fellow actors and professionals on the set as well, they understand that.
You have to. You honestly, it's a bit more about honouring the work again, I suppose, because there are, you know, there's a woman who's been baking the particular petit four.
Yeah.
She's been up since 2 a.m. to get it right and fresh for this moment on the day. There are supporting artists who've driven halfway across the country in the night to be here for their 5:30 call. You know, there are people that have been decorating and setting things up, never mind the writer's room and the... There's an awful lot of work that goes into the and turnover and action moment for you. So for you to not come... and be on point, excuse me, who are you? So there's a lot of me that thinks about that. And I also think, David, I grew up in a farming village in the middle of the Cotswolds. What? I'm doing this? What?
I know.
If you're doing it, come on and do it, love.
Yeah, if you're here, enjoy it. And actually, you know, it's fine because you do love it, so it's great. But it is that every now and again you go, how great is it? I mean, was the one day, what was the one day that you suddenly went on set and went, oh my God, this is massive? Was there a day in your first week where you looked around at the extras and the carriages and just thought, wow?
There was a ball scene. It was an outdoor ball. Oh, I can't remember what it was. I can't remember what it was, David, but it was quite early on. And it's quite early on in the shoot. I can't remember if it's early on in the story. It's outdoors. It's night. There's fireworks. Mm. There's a lake.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
flambeau. There's 75 bajillion people. It's a bit muddy underfoot, let's be honest. There's planks and whatnot everywhere. The shot was so enormous. I just thought, I actually don't know what am I? I don't know what I'm doing. And I just went, okay, baby, come on. We're going to have to knuckle down for this one because there is so much going on. Yeah. Actually that's when you have to just go, you have to get really tiny now because the people can't do, there's no, there's drones fly. It's like, you know.
But also it's that thing of you know, you go, this is amazing. Whereas Lady Danbury would go, this is my life. I'm here. This
Lady
is
Danbury would go, oh, right. Okay. Why is he over there? You know.
So there's that thing of playing the character.
There's always that split thing, isn't there?
Yeah.
I mean, I still get that some days. At the moment, I'm working in I'm doing loads of audiobooks through lockdown. Gosh. Mm. I'm doing loads of audiobooks and I find a route and I drive in North London. And I live in South London. I drive past Buckingham Palace most days. Mm-hmm. And there's still a little bit of me that's like, here, look at you, all right. You're going to work in your fancy car and you're driving past Buckingham Palace.
Quite right. Quite right. The minute you lose that, it's all gone.
You're gone. You're gone.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah.
We'll be back with more chat after this.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, you're listening to Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey. Now, back to this week's episode. When did you first see it all put together? Did you go to a bit? Were you able to do a big screening because of COVID or not?
Yes, we had an end of shoot sort of montage of lots of sexy sections, mm-hmm. followed by, you know, much dancing and drinking. But then we weren't able to do a full Monty because we finished filming at the end of February before lockdown. And so when it would have all been put together, there was no gathering. So I watched the whole thing. They sent out episodes, I'm in a carriage, there's a green screen, right, that sort of stuff, and placeholder music and characters talking, and then the lines have been added. So it's like, well, I don't know what I think. And then he does the thing, and I'm like, you know, that sort of stuff. So that was the first put together I saw. And then obviously it was a completely different order of gravy by the time they put the proper, you know, this is a chamber quartet, but I think I recognize that music and all the schwang on it. It was a completely different thing again.
That's
and
really, when you suddenly go, is that Ariana Grande? That's just, you know, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
I loved all that.
And that's the fun of it as well. You know, it's the same as the psychedelic green dress. It's like the musical equivalent of some of Chris's stage directions. You get a little nod into that world of, we're not taking ourselves too seriously.
But you were saying before, I mean, you know, where you come from and stuff. I mean, you studied law, didn't you? So where did the acting bug come? Where did that come from for you?
Listen, I was that annoying kid, David. I was putting on shows in the front room. I think I'd choreographed Gustav Holst's The Planet Suite by the time I was 8 with like Maxine and Helen and Doreen Ryan, the kids up the road. I was always dressing up and playing things. I used to make books. I would stitch together stuff and I'd, you know, with my felt tips, and I'd have quizzes and a dot to dot. And all this, and little comic strip books and all that, for all the stuff that you get in an annual. Yeah. I was that kid. So I was always doing plays or playing dress up. I had a friend at primary school, Tina Morley. I was the Russian prince. No, I was the Russian prince, and she was the peasant girl. That was they played that one quite a lot.
Right. But did you ever go to like a drama club or anything like that? Or was
in
this
the
all
Cotswolds?
Self- no, it doesn't happen. No.
There were school plays. That was as much of a drama club as we got. We weren't allowed to study drama at school because it wasn't a proper subject. In the upper sixth form, I stayed on to the sixth form. I did A-levels. If you were doing A-levels, you were allowed to do drama O-level. We had a drama teacher called Vera Connor Douglas. But she was known as Vera Connors, Miss Connors. I wish that she'd lived longer. She'd been a professional actor. So to me, she was like a god. And she would give me notes and she would say, I'm giving you this note as a professional actor. And I'd be like, oh, okay. And she gave me her gold lame 1950s slingbacks, which I've still got somewhere, as a present after we'd done Murder in the Red Barn, I think. And I played the gypsy, of course. I would always get those character parts. In the sixth form, I was, my parents were getting divorced. I was very depressed. I lost a lot of weight and drama got me through. Yeah. And I had a really clear sense. I went to see David Hare's Plenty, Kate Nelligan, 1979. I had to go and write a report for my drama O level. I went on my own. I sat in the cheap seats at Bristol Old Vic, and the story had nothing to do with my life. I was a depressed anorexic 16-year-old. And this is a woman who, in the Second World War, she's taken out of her secretarial job in London. She becomes a special ops operator in France. She's brilliant at it. She comes into her pomp. She finds out who she is as a human being. She has a great love affair, blah, 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 blah. And then at the end, the war finishes and it's like, you go back to being a secretary, love. And it's about her falling apart. And I remember sitting in the, you know, sitting in this, I don't know, Wednesday matinee and just sobbing my heart out in the dark. And I understood then that there was something magical and transformational about theatre. About storytelling, and I wanted to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be a part of it with an instinct that didn't extend to you can do it as a job. I just knew it was something. But where I grew up, if you were bright, you might apply to join the civil service, or you might work in a bank, or if it was available to you, you might even think about university.
So you had to go and find it yourself.
I did the law degree because I'm a good African daughter, but I didn't do it until after I'd worked for Lloyds Bank for a year during the Falklands.
Right.
I was a punk, David. Mm-hmm. So I'm in a bank and there's people in Lady Di blouses and there's blokes who are in the TA talking about how they're going to go and give the Argies some. It's numbers. I was shit at it. We had to, at the end of the day, be like, okay, someone's out. And they'd be like, Adge, is it you? So I was bad. I was bad, 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 bad. So in the end, I ended up applying for a law degree to just get out of the bank. Right. And I'm an African. That's, good African. You'll be a lawyer, be a doctor. Mm-hmm. If you're bad, you can be an accountant. Mm-hmm. But that was sort of it. So I did, and I thought, right, I'll go and be a law degree. I'll do a law degree. I'll do benefits rights. I'll do immigration law. Because my politics were really, my politics haven't changed. I've probably got more chippy as I've got older, actually. Mm-hmm. So I did 2 years of this law degree, hated it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to know how to stiff the tenants, actually. It's not interested. Mm-hmm. In my first year, a woman called Yvonne Ramzaran, she's a magistrate in Bristol and a lawyer and a brilliant, brilliant woman. She was in Bristol Black Women's Group because in those days, so Yvonne is Indian, Guyanese, Irish. And in those days, black meant what we'd say of colour now. So that was Turkish women, African heritage women, Chinese women, Asian. It was a black women's group. And Yvonne said to me, because we're still friends, she said, someone in the second year ran up to went, Yvonne, there's one in the first year. And that was me. And it was like, recruit her, get her in. So I joined Bristol Black Women's Group. And it was the joy of my life. I'd come from the Cotswolds. I'd worked for the bank. I was a punk. My politics were left. And then I came to Bristol Polytechnic and joined this Bristol Black Women's Group and discovered, Audre Lorde and Alice Walker and the politics of feminism from a position of colour. And my whole world went, whoo, Sweet Honey in the Rock, this music a cappella ensemble, who were completely, they were supporting trade unions and women's rights and Indigenous. I mean, it was just like, okay, I found my people. Right. So in Bristol Black Women's Group, we went to Greenham Common. We did all of that. There was a woman called Deborah John Wilson, who, thanks to Bridgerton, has recently got in touch with me. She lives in America now. I'm so happy. Because I mentioned her. Somebody was asking me about how I started. Anyway, Deborah had been in the San Francisco meme troupe, and she was working in Bristol. And when I eventually surrendered and packed in my law degree, she said, I'm going to do some classes at the community centre. Come do my class. So I went and did Deborah's class at the St. Werburgh's Community Centre. And eventually she got funded by Ken Livingston to do a show in London, and she said, you should audition. So I came up to London. I auditioned for a director called Sally Abrahamian, who's a TV and film director now, but was theatre director then, still pals. And and then I went back to my bedsit in Bristol, and by this time I was working in the Legal Aid Centre as an assistant, and got offered a job. So April 1984, so it's my 37th anniversary this month. I went to my mum and my stepfather's wedding, and then one of my relations who lived in London was coming back up to London, and I moved up to London with my then girlfriend, who I'd met when Bristol Black Women's Group had had a sororial meeting with Brixton Black Women's Group, because we did those things in those days. So I moved in with Dorothea, and I rehearsed at the Drill Hall. The dear old Drill Hall. And we did the show there. We did it at the Oval House, and we did it at the Acton Community Centre. It was five black women. There was music in it, and it was fantastic. And then I just never went back.
That's how
I started.
And how did
and
that
I lived
go
in a squat
with-
for a year, and I cleaned toilets and modelled for life drawing classes. And then black actresses started to tell me about auditions. And for me, that was like, they were putting me in opposition with them to get work so that I would have the opportunity to work. And so for me, that's always been a thing about don't climb over people. Mm-hmm. If it's yours, you'll get it. If it's not, help someone else get it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how did that change of profession go down with your family? Was there any resistance to that?
Oh, listen, I'd already ruined my father by not finishing the law degree.
Right.
Because I'd walked out on that to do Deborah's classes, and I took up the cello with the head of the law department who'd said he'd wished he'd packed in his law when he was younger. So my dad did the thing I would probably do with my kids, which is, was like, just finish it, just finish it. If you don't want to, just finish the degree. I was like, I can't, I don't want to do it. So I left. So I'd already, you know, he's still waiting for me to finish the law degree somewhere in his heart. I know he is. Right.
But they've been able to see your success as well.
Yeah.
You made the right choice.
I made the right choice for me. I just think I'm a better actor than I would have been a lawyer. Yeah. And my mum, you know, my mum's extraordinary. She's from Liverpool. They moved to Bristol. She married an African. Her family didn't go to the wedding. Mm-hmm. She'd been working with post-war refugees in Austria in the 50s. She's like, my mum is just out there. She taught in Leeds. She taught contemporary dance, and she got drama going. And so for her, she was just like, do your thing. Yeah, and she's still like, do your thing. That's your thing. Do your thing.
And you're one of the actors who does, well, your thing is everything. I mean, you do, you telly, theatre, film, you direct. I've seen some great shows that you've directed. You're Richard II, I loved. You know, you do audio books, you mentioned before, radio. Mm. I mean, you cover it all. Do you have any sort of plan? Have you ever had any sort of plan, or do you just take what you want to do and as it comes along, the things that you would like to challenge yourself in, or is there a plan?
I wish I had a plan, David. I haven't got a plan. You know, there's some of the super famous actors I've worked with, you know, the ones that have talk about, you know, which airspace is the best airspace to fly their small light engine where I might go, you know, that's a good car park. They're like, right. They're still going. So what are you doing next? I think we never lose the fear that we're never going to work again. Well, I don't anyway. No, and it seems to me that it's always like, right, well, no, that's, well, me
we
then.
Must sort of enjoy that. I mean, there must be something in it that's sort of perverse in us that we sort of, you know, the next thing is always a bit of a panic, really, you know. Let's just talk a little bit because I'm conscious of time, and I just want to get onto something that doesn't get talked about a lot, which is basically things like reviews and nerves. You mentioned before that your first drama tutor said, I'm going to give you a note now as a professional actor. Mm. Times in my life when I've got very defensive around notes as a director. So a director can approach me and I can think, oh, don't come anywhere near me. And that's, I know that's a fault in me. There's an insecurity in me. You're a director as well as an actress. So is there a way that a director can give notes? Do you feel knocked by notes? How do you deal with that sometimes?
I think it's always about buy-in, isn't it? I always feel, I'm directors who are horrible to me don't get the best out of me. Mm. They get fear. And they get defensiveness, and you get Adjoa and not the character, because I just come to the front and I'm like, and there's a bit, they don't like me. I shouldn't be here. You know, it's like, that's not useful. That's not useful for the creative process. So it's got to be about buy-in. Mm-hmm. So I will want to sit with someone and say, so this is what it's, I don't know. How are you feeling with it? Is this, cause I always feel there's, It's flow, David. It's like when you're watching your Leeds United back in the Premiership. I thank you. When you're watching your team just being beautiful, when the flow is in and everything comes together, when that player is there and you have to look at the pass, when the flow is right, it's right. So I'm always interested in getting the flow. Mm. I was... I've just been doing a short film with a young director called Dipo Barua Etta, who's just beautiful. And you know when it's the right take.
Yeah.
When you do it and you both go, yeah. So that's what I'm trying to work. That's what I'm trying to get to when I'm working with actors.
The football analogy is very good, because sometimes you talk about you need an arm around a player, you need to sort of quiet, and another time you need to kick them up the arse. And there's times when a director has done both with me, and I've gone, and you have to, you know, I don't like a bully, and I know a bully, and you know, yeah, that's happening, I'm not having it. But if someone is challenging me,
and challenge is good,
and I have to be aware of it in myself to think, this is right. They are trying to get something out of me which is right. I'm frightened. I'm frightened to open up. I'm frightened to give.
Yeah, and when you own that, that's really helpful, isn't it? There's a director I love working with, Indu Rubisingham, theatre director. She runs The Kiln. And she always laughs because she'll give me a note and I'll go, no. Yes, yes. So I'm quite often a no-yes person. It's like, yeah. No, yes. And that's really good to open yourself to that. But it's almost like the bartering. You know, when you're bartering with someone and you're like, I'll give you a fiver for that. And they'll go, £6.50. And you go, no, a fiver. And they go, it's £6.50. No lower. So, and I think the same, you know, I'm going to try what you want because I'm going to try and be open. And sometimes it gives me a great discovery as an actor. And other times I'm just like, that's not the right path. And I can tell you why it's not the right. So I'm really happy to have the back and forth. But as you say, so if we're doing Shakespeare, David, like when we were doing Richard II, so I had 3 days of, I did, let's have cultural sharing. So I want you to bring in poetry, songs, a dance routine, a bit of film you like, a sculpture, and a piece of cake. Don't care what it is. Bring something that resonates with you from your life. We did 3 days of for the buy-in. I want the buy-in. I want everybody to be on project, whatever it is, Richard II in this case. But then it's like, okay, the rhythm is bajinka jinka jink. Sorry, that's what it is. And then I will be completely hard ass about some bit of text because it will open something else up. Just trust that it will. So it's as you say, it's a real give and take thing. But
in theatre, you get that. I mean, sometimes, you know, on TV, sometimes, and again, you've done, you know, episodic fast television, you're being asked to make choices very quickly
on the hoof. Sometimes as you step onto the set when they give you the pink page.
Yeah. And that you've got to sort of have a trust in yourself at those times. I mean, that's why, that thing of having a plan. It seems to me your plan is to mix it up all the time, to do different things. And I think in that idea of you grabbing something from theatre, grabbing something from episodic television, doing something from big movies, and then the audio books, they're all feeding you and your experience of how to tell story and give story over, isn't it?
How to tell story. I love it. I do love it all. What I hate is crap work. So I don't care what the medium is. If it's good, it's good. If it's crap, it's crap. But what I love is, say you're doing an audiobook, you have to apply yourself in a really particular way. You are the narrator. You are all the characters. You have to hold all the stakes, all the different emotionalities. And, you know, is it a narrator who's a sort of a reliable narrator, an unreliable narrator? Are they omniscient? Are they funny? Are they miserable? You know, so you're holding the whole frame. So that's a completely different demand on you. And I love that. You know, I'm going to be a bit Welsh. Now I'm going to be a bit Nigerian. Now I'm going to be a bit, you know, Chicago and whatever it is. And I love the challenge of that because it's just your acting chops. It's like, okay, yeah, I can do all of that. But then, you know, you're doing a really tiny chamber piece on stage. How do you, what's the nuance and the freighting of that? Or you're doing a big movie and it's going to be 40 foot, you know, whatever. So it's a slight raise of an eyebrow. So I love the different challenges that it all demands of you. I'm still thrilled that I'm working as an actor. So I wish I did have a plan. I think it might be helpful, but I don't have a plan, David.
I mean, the one thing I've had to learn is that that my experience sometimes as I've got older, I've gone, oh, I'm quite comfortable with it. I'm okay with this. I know it. And I became very suspicious of that feeling because I'd worked from panic most of my life. I'd worked from a place of insecurity, a place of panic. If it wasn't, you know, no pain, no gain. And I got to a job where I thought, oh, I'm nervous and, you know, I'm sort of anxious about stuff, but I'm not feeling that inner panic. And I thought, maybe I'm just getting... And then it really worried me that I wasn't getting the panic.
Yeah.
I had to realize to let that go and just enjoy it. Even though it is does create anxiety, is nervous, I can enjoy it as well.
I think it's about that thing about honoring your experience and sort of saying, do you know what? I'm quite good at this. I don't have to be terrified all the time because I know what I'm doing. You know, we wouldn't want our surgeons to be terrified every time they went to operate on us. And it's the same. It's, of course, they'll be prepared and they'll be nervous because that's about focus. But, you know, we've been doing this a long time and we still get hired. So you're allowed to own the fact that you are pretty good at what you do. That's okay.
Allowed to enjoy it. I think that's what we'll do. Adrian, it's so great to talk to you. I love the show. And you've mentioned the second season. Is that out there now?
We had a table read recently and we're back in harness shortly. Yeah.
Oh, well, I can't wait. I really, honestly, it was so great and I loved it. And I think it is groundbreaking. It is great, game changing and all for it. It's just wonderful on so many levels.
Oh, bless you. Thanks, David.
Thanks for joining me today.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Who Am I This Time? Is a Just Voices and Doolally production. Produced by Simon Lennigan. Music by Greg Hatlow. Edited and mixed by Russ Keffett at Audio Egg. And presented by me, David Morrissey.